This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, a rebroadcast of an interview from June with Bridge reporter Jim Malowitz. He highlighted the lack of lifeguards on Great Lakes beaches in Michigan. But first,
1968 was the year that Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy were assassinated. That year also saw the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, President Lyndon Johnson's decision not to run for re-election, and chaos at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. As the nation was in turmoil, college graduates were still collecting diplomas and preparing to enter what is called the real world 50 years ago. Western Michigan University's class of 1968 is marking its 50th class reunion with events surrounding this week's season opening football game. Rick Markoff was Western's senior class president in 1968. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Gordon.
As we sit here and talk, does it seem like 50 years have gone by, or are there things that you remember that seem more like maybe they were 50 minutes ago?
It seems more like 50 minutes ago. The time has gone by ever so rapidly.
And what was it like to be a college student in 1968? Some of the things I mentioned there in the intro were going on in the world. Did that create a certain feeling on campus?
Well, it was an amazing time to be a student on any college campus, but I think especially at Western Michigan University, there were four really big issues that not only faced college students, but faced our nation and literally were facing the world at that particular time. You touched upon race relations, Vietnam. There was the race for space, as well as this major cultural change with regard to drugs and music and free speech. And all that was intertwined with just trying to be a college student, and it was an amazing time, reported to by the likes of people like Walter Cronkite. There were so many dramatic things that were happening in the state of Michigan at that time. The burning of a number of buildings in Detroit in that very difficult summer going into our senior year. The assassination of Martin Luther King. Many people have no idea that on the campus at Western, the day after Martin Luther King was assassinated, a number of students took over the student union and locked themselves inside, African-American students. And many of us who were student leaders stood on the steps of the student union for more than 8 hours until calmer minds prevailed and the administration was able to work out some things with the students inside. And that was a very, very difficult day in the April of 1968.
Markoff says graduates that year had to consider whether they wanted to enlist, perhaps be drafted, or find a way to stay out of the war in Vietnam. At the same time, the counterculture and drugs were in the background.
And all those question marks in people's minds were reflected in the music of the time, songs that came out for peace, songs that came out about what was going on with regard to going on in the world. And on campus at that time, while all this was taking place, there were a number of different speakers who came to the Western Michigan campus, from the Reverend Dr. Malcolm Boyd to Nazi leader George Lincoln Rockwell. And if you allow me, I want to read a quote from the Western Herald from George Lincoln Rockwell and tell me what this sounds like. In the very first paragraph of an article, it says, "My followers and I are a counter-revolutionary movement. We are getting distorted news, managed news, and false news. We are being kept from the facts. Things that people feel like are just now happening were going on 50 years ago." And so, and tied all these things together was a tremendous race for space, Sputnik, the Apollo program, an emphasis on math and science. So that's just a taste of what was going on in the world and in the minds of students in 1968.
Well, let's go back for a moment there to what you mentioned about the assassination of Martin Luther King. And then the students, some of the African-American students actually engaging in protest. How tense was that moment when you wondered kind of, I guess, you know, what was going to finally happen with the students talking to the administration?
It was extremely tense. Friends who were in dorms together, fraternities together, sororities together, to people who knew each other growing up in Kalamazoo or Portage or whatever suburb, all of a sudden, when the assassination took place, lines were drawn. Ethnicity was so important, showing the strength that was needed at that very difficult time was definitely something that none of us had ever had to cope with before. College was this very special place. It was almost like utopia, where the cares of the world seemed to be outside or didn't quite impact you nearly as much when you were a college student. But all of a sudden, with the assassination of Martin Luther King, the real world came to our doorstep, and we all had to react, and all of us grew up an awful lot in those days of April of 1968.
As you noted, there were tensions over race and maybe over some other issues. You were in a position of student leadership. Did you think that there was a certain responsibility for the way you should handle yourself and the way you should interact with students, given some of the various, I guess you might say, polarization that was happening?
I think that it brought out the best in leadership skills for many of us. And I take a look at the successes that so many individuals had when they graduated from Western, going on to find medical careers, find legal careers, community service, you name it, and business leaders, so on and so forth. And every opportunity or every adversity actually gave an opposite and equal seed for opportunity to do good. And I think that far more students came out in that particular vein.
At the same time, Western Michigan University was growing. 2,000 more students arrived on campus for the 1967-68 academic year, bringing enrollment at that time to 18,500. Miller Auditorium opened in January of 1968. And Rick Markoff says there was new technology at the university.
Computers were just coming onto campus at that time, and those who were learning to use a computer were their computers were driven by punch cards, and most individuals have no idea what a punch card happens to be. And the year, my junior year, was what they called the Great Storm of 1967, which just in one fell swoop delivered more than 2 feet of snow on campus and closed down the campus for 5 days. And so those were just some of the things that were going on at that particular time that were a little bit more fun to look back on.
And as you note, there were a couple of those items. It certainly was a time where Western Michigan University was growing in terms of the number of students. Doctoral programs were just kind of getting started at that time, and then the opening of Miller Auditorium. Could you appreciate that as a student, that this university that you had decided to attend was kind of taking off a little bit and going in some new directions?
Oh, it was an amazing time as far as growth of the university. And but it was anchored by excellent stability. As I mentioned, Jim Miller was the president. Dr. Russell Seibert was the vice president for academic affairs. And they were brilliant, brilliant men. Athletics were anchored by two of the great names in Western sports coaching, and Charlie Maher, who was the baseball coach, and George Dales, who brought national championship cross country to the university. A fun fact was the first concert I ever went to at Western. I paid $1 to go see my first concert at Reed Fieldhouse. And for $1, the entertainers were Mary Wells, the Shirelles, Major Lance, and Jay and the Americans. And we had back-to-back football All-Americans at that time in Bob Rowe and in Dale Livingston, who both went on to have very fine professional careers. And so not only was there growth, but there was so much fun that was going on. And the more fun that I had, my GPA kept going further and further down. But I had such a great experience being involved in student life, and which allowed me to have, and for so many to have, bring out the best as far as not only an excellent academic preparation, but a preparation for life, period.
But we mentioned Vietnam a while back. You would end up serving in Vietnam a couple of years after you left Western. Take us through what happened.
Right. You know, it's not only me. The gentleman who is the vice chairman of this reunion, Norm Gottlieb. Let me talk about Norm first before me, because more people in Kalamazoo might recognize Norm. Norm graduated from Kalamazoo Central, came to Western. He was captain of the track team and president of the varsity at the W Club at that time. Norm went on from ROTC at Western Michigan University to become an aviator in the Army, went to, after his training at Fort Knox and down in Alabama, where he learned how to fly helicopters, went to Vietnam and flew what were called Cobra attack helicopters on the demilitarized zone. Norm was very highly decorated, went on to a career that lasted parts of four decades in the Army, served at the Pentagon and in Crystal City, and retired as a full bird colonel. In 2004, Norm was inducted into Western's ROTC Hall of Fame, and he is an amazing individual, born and raised in Kalamazoo. My career was absolutely very small compared to Norm's, as I spent 2 years in the military after getting my bachelor's at Western and before I got my doctorate at the University of Toledo. I went to the University of Missouri and got a master's in higher education and also my ROTC commission. And after various stints at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and Fort Knox, and back to Fort Sill for Vietnam orientation, spent a tour of duty in Vietnam. And believe it or not, Norm and I had the opportunity to get together while we were stationed in Vietnam. We've been together all over the world. The long and the short of it is that, and this is just one person's opinion, as I mentioned, my grandparents came to the United States so that they could avoid religious persecution. My father and my future father-in-law at that time both served in the Army during World War II. And what I found when I went to Vietnam, for sure, is that we are ever so lucky to have all the great things that freedom allows us to have in this country. And I also found that Uncle Sam has always been much better to me than I've been to Uncle Sam.
Rick Markoff says serving in the military allowed him to grow up, make mistakes, and learn how to listen.
We do indeed live in the greatest country in the world and blessed with wonderful institutions like Western Michigan University. And I'm just so glad that I had that opportunity. And, I wouldn't trade that experience for anything else I've done ever.
And tell us some more about what you did do after serving in the military, getting your doctorate at the University of Toledo. Where did life take you from there?
Well, one third of my career was in college administration. I served as alumni relations director at Western Michigan University, associate vice president at Adrian College. From there, I spent one third of my career as a hospital administrator in Toledo as the president of a major hospital foundation. And then in 1995, my wife and I along with our younger son, because our older son was already at Ohio State, went to Indianapolis. And the vast majority of my time spent in Indianapolis, I headed up what's called the Simon Youth Foundation for Simon Property Group and the Simon Family. Simon Property Group is the nation's largest and the world's largest owner of upscale retail space, malls. And what we did is we put schools and malls for at-risk youth or high school-age kids and had a major scholarship program. And I was able to give out more than $1.4 million a year in scholarships. Retired at age 64 for 4 days and became the senior advisor to the chancellor at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, and taught graduate courses in organization leadership. Went to retire, but at age 67, 68, and was asked to create a foundation for the state's largest provider of services for those who have autism and other mental challenges, and which was a very rewarding year and a half. But I promised myself I would never work at age 70, so I retired. Retirement is wonderful, and I'm pleased to say that next month, the University of Toledo Press is publishing my first book, and so I've managed to stay very busy in retirement.
That doesn't even sound like retirement yet if you're writing a book while you're retired.
Well, retirement is something that, you know, if you are proactive and take it by the horns, it can be tremendously exciting. The great thing is you can do when you want to do it, what you want to do, and how you want to do it. The book item was something that I never had time to do when I was working and as a husband and a father and someone who is involved in the community. And so this is great, and that it was a fun project. It's about, the name of the book is Million Dollar Memories and the Amazing Professionals Who Helped Make Them Possible. And it's about some of the finest fundraisers in the United States, either the first $1 million gift that they raised or their most impactful $1 million gift. And it'll be a great read for people who are interested in nonprofits or who serve on boards, who are volunteers for various nonprofit organizations, or whoever considered making a transformational gift to an organization, a nonprofit that they highly revere. So that's what's been going on.
So I want to go back to something that you said early on, that certainly 1968, America was very divided. And we live in a time now when people, again, see us as being divided and things are very polarized. Can you compare then to now? I mean, do you see similarities and do you see differences?
That's a very good question. I see a difference in this country because of the fact that for some reason at the present time, the word civility seems to have disappeared. There was always, no matter how much you may have disagreed with someone else over a political issue, over a social issue, over whatever the issue might have been, there was always a show of respect for your opponent and a desire to find ways of being able to work together. The word compromise was something that was positive in nature and not negative in nature. And I think that people really, because of the fact that there were so many new Americans and first-time educated individuals, that it was much, much easier to find ways to create wins for your opponent, wins for you, and wins for the people that you served. And people don't seem to want to work. And once again, this is just one person talking. And so I hope that your listeners will understand that it's only one person's opinion. But people may not work as hard today to try and find those win-win-win solutions. And it behooves us because of the fact, as I said, what I learned in the service and seeing what other people don't have versus what we have. If we only realize all the blessings that we have in this country, I think we would work much, much harder together to find solutions to whatever seems to ail us and go forward.
Rick Markoff was president of Western Michigan University's senior class in 1968. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
A series of events are planned at Western Michigan University this week for the class of 1968's 50th reunion. Links with details can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. High winds led to some dangerous conditions in the Great Lakes this summer. The Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project says that 75 people have drowned in the Great Lakes this year, 25 of those in Lake Michigan. Bridge reporter Jim Malowitz highlighted the efforts to keep people safe and warned the public about the dangers of the Great Lakes. The interview with Jim Malowitz originally aired in June. So just how dangerous can it be for someone to go swimming in one of the Great Lakes?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, a lot of people would think these are just lakes. It's not the ocean. There aren't any sharks or anything like that. But some of the safety experts that I've been talking to say that the Great Lakes can be quite dangerous. You can get caught in various dangerous currents, including rip currents. And they have some tips for ways to escape strong currents if you're caught in the Great Lakes. These are huge bodies of water, and a lot can happen on them.
And are there certain conditions where it gets more dangerous, certain things that might be happening on the lakes where the chance becomes greater that something horrible can happen?
Sure, and those are probably the strong currents, and rip currents tend to get the most attention. That's basically when there's maybe a sandbar that's channeling the water. It's flowing out back at you as you're maybe parallel to shore quickly. And safety experts say that there's really no way to fight a current like that, even if you're a Michael Phelps-type character. So the idea to escape a current like that would be to swim parallel to shore and then try to swim in once you're able to escape the current, and also to flip on your back to try to conserve your energy while you're caught in that current and kind of find your way to shore.
And one of your stories introduces us to a gentleman named Bob Pratt, who is trying to educate more people about these techniques and trying to be safe on the water. But when he's out there teaching people, does he find that this knowledge is lacking amongst swimmers?
He does, and that's something that he and a lot of other safety advocates, water safety advocates, are saying, is that we train kids to know how to know what to do when there's a fire, stop, drop, and roll. There's even earthquake drills at some schools, maybe not in Michigan, but in some Great Lakes states. And we're preparing kids for various safety hazards, but it's their contention that there's very little talked about when it comes to drowning, and then that's actually a pretty major cause of death for young kids.
Bob Pratt is also one of the leaders in trying to find out more about the number of people who die on the Great Lakes every year. How much can we look at data in terms of drownings on the Great Lakes? Is there some sort of a place where we can find those numbers readily right now?
Not a government source. And so Pratt's group, Pratt is a former East Lansing fire chief who has then founded an organization he runs now, which is the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project. And he discovered around 2003, 2004, that no government agency was really tracking how many people were drowning on the Great Lakes, and he contended that that would be an important step because these lakes are unique and you got to figure out what the trends are and how to stay safe. So his very small nonprofit group has started compiling stats on Great Lakes drownings, and he's monitoring various news reports, police reports. He gets official tips, and he's basically combing various sources to compile this data to then be able to analyze it and see what some of the trends are. But still, even the U.S. Center for Disease Control, they do track deaths in various ways, but not in a way that you can pull out to figure out how many people are drowning in the Great Lakes.
One of the things that you tell us in your story is that Bob Pratt is pretty careful about how he tries to put these numbers together. He includes people who maybe die later on when they've obviously struggled in the water and those injuries have led to death, but he tries to make sure that he leaves out someone where it's an obvious suicide. Even with that, is it still perhaps incomplete data in some way when it's somebody who is doing this, you know, as sort of a cause as opposed to a government agency putting it together?
Sure, perhaps. Yeah, and he acknowledges that there could be deaths that they're missing. You know, it's him and one partner at the nonprofit that they're doing this. And yeah, he thinks it's a pretty good number, but acknowledges that it could be even a little bit higher. And it's hard to be exact, but they're really the only ones taking a comprehensive look at this.
And yet, with the number of deaths that we're able to pinpoint and perhaps acknowledge that it's not the complete picture, it's pretty common to swim somewhere on the Great Lakes and not have a lifeguard on duty, correct?
That's correct. And the case that Pratt and advocates are making is that Michigan in particular has more miles of unguarded beaches than other states. If you look, for instance, at the southern part of Lake Michigan, where a large percentage of drownings in the Great Lakes occur, particularly because it's busier down there, you can see that on the Illinois and Indiana side, there's quite a few lifeguards in a lot of places, and that could partially be because of population distribution. But then you get over to the Michigan side, and there are very, very few beaches that are guarded. And the state a couple of decades ago pulled lifeguards from state parks that had beaches, and sort of one by one over time, municipalities in Michigan have been yanking their lifeguards.
But your one story opens up by telling us about New Buffalo, and New Buffalo was going to get rid of the lifeguards on their beaches. What happened?
Well, there's a major backlash, and the city council had just proposed and it was just going to discuss a new budget that didn't have money for lifeguards. And the safety advocates, but also just the everyday public, really responded strongly that they did not like that idea. There was very heated testimony at a public meeting, and the city council decided to stay the course for now and to hire 6 to 9 lifeguards for the coming season for weekends and holidays like they used to.
There's an interesting comment, though, from the New Buffalo City Manager, David Richards, about liability here. And this is a little counterintuitive, I think, when a lot of people hear it. But in a way, he says perhaps having lifeguards could open up a city to more legal liability. Explain what the thinking is there.
That's the thinking that some city officials hold, that if there's a lifeguard, that means that there could be lifeguard error, that the city could be liability if something happened and the lifeguard didn't save someone struggling in the water, or that they could be liable perhaps for a lifeguard that sues the city for conditions, that kind of thing. And this is something that as a reporter, I would like to spend more time looking at than I had for this article, because there's kind of a debate between the safety folks and the city folks about that. There are some people, I did talk to some insurance folks from other states who contend that having lifeguards does not make you more liable, at least in the case of Illinois. I didn't get a chance to reach out to a Michigan expert on that, but that's definitely an ongoing debate. But it is the case that cities have faced lawsuits kind of on both sides of the issue. There have been settlements that related to unguarded beaches and lawsuits from guarded beaches. So that's something I still kind of want to take a look at.
Jim, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You can read the stories by Jim Malowitz on safety in the Great Lakes and the efforts to prevent drownings in Bridge at bridgemi.com. Links are also available at wmuk.org. The interview with Jim Malowitz originally aired in June. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.